You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith, and in this episode I'm talking to Andy Osho. Now, this is an episode which should have gone out several months ago, and I don't know why it didn't. Many apologies to Andy. This was timed to coincide with the release of Curfew on Sky, which we will talk about briefly. I believe you can still get that on Catch Up or on Now TV or any of those other Sky things that you've been watching Game of Thrones on. We are going to talk, Andy is a sort of an old friend. I've not seen her for a long time, but it was really lovely to catch up with her, having not seen her for a while. And we very quickly get into the meat of some stuff. She's been, she's had an extraordinary career, probably around about 2012. Her star was burning as brightly as stars tend to burn on the UK comedy scene. She was on all the TV shows, all the panel shows, and you can still see some phenomenal clips of her very, very striking, powerful and well-authored stand-up at Live at the Apollo and so forth. You can catch up with all of those online on YouTube. And then something went wrong, and we're going to start talking about that sort of pretty much from the off. So my thanks to Andy for being so upfront and so candid. I really enjoyed this episode, and it is to my shame that it slipped out of the release schedule, and it was up to Jake, my logging elf, who said, "Are you going to ever release that one?" And I poo-pooed his email and said, no, that went out months ago. Check the thing again." And I checked, and he was absolutely right. So apologies to Jake. Very many apologies to Andy. I am very pleased now to be bringing you this episode with the brilliant Andy Osho.
Where have you been?
Oh, mate. Like, it's been a while, hasn't it? I went to LA. I took myself off to LA.
Okay. Yeah. Took yourself off. Does that suggest you weren't invited? You were like, I'm going to go and smash the doors down?
Okay. So what happened was, I suppose the term would be burnt out. Like, everything happened very quickly in a very intense period of time. And no matter what I did, I was just exhausted all the time. And I was pretty depressed, actually. I know that on the surface, what was going on for me at that time was someone's dream. It just turned out that it wasn't mine.
So and just for those of us that don't know, what was going on at the time?
So I was doing, you know, the panel shows, and I'd done two Live at the Apollos by that point. And, you know, just stuff was coming my way. It was everything that, you know, when you start out in a comedy career, you dare to dream of but don't expect. And, you know, those things were starting to come my way. You know, I'd done, two Edinburgh shows, toured 3 times, played the O2 with a bunch of other people, but, you know, nonetheless, still stood in front of 15,000 people. You know, I'd done all these things, and I just got to sort of somewhere in 2012 and just thought, this isn't working. like something about this isn't working. I mean, this is all me retrofitting an explanation. At the time, I was just very depressed. I was exhausted. I was starting to feel like this experience of separation from the person who was going on stage and myself. Like, even now, I was talking to a friend about this last night, and even now I refer to her sometimes as though she's another person, because, you know, I don't speak like her anymore. I don't think like her. I don't dress like her, for sure. I mean, I don't have the legs for those dresses anymore. But, like, you know what I mean? Like, she's a different person. And what's really interesting, especially, like, with Dave, you know, where there's repeats and stuff like that, and people respond to her, to me. They tell me, it's like someone telling me, oh, I saw your sister on TV last night. She was great. It's like, cool, all right, thanks, yeah. Okay. Do you know what I mean? Like, yeah. I sort of got such a separation from her now.
And just describe her in a bit more detail for people who haven't seen her. I mean, everyone can go online and see this. Yeah. Tons of clips, tons of... viewership, you know, whatever the word is, tons of watches or whatever, likes and things.
Yeah,
it's all out there. Yeah. If people are listening to this and haven't seen her.
Yes,
and I'm fascinated by that, because we get that often, but with people talking about characters, and that sounds like that's almost kind of verging on what it was. I mean, she. I'm gonna call her me. I'm gonna go with it. No, I'm gonna go
right,
with it.
Okay.
Andy Osho of 2012.
Yeah.
Describe her in as you remember her.
She was, I guess, you know, I don't like the word sassy particularly, but yeah, there's some sass, some sort of, you know, street about her, and she was straight talking, and, you know, I suppose when I was trying to label what I was doing, I guess it was sort of social commentary, because I didn't talk about myself very much. And even when I did, you know, I did a show about relationships, I didn't really give anything away about myself. I was pretty closed in that respect. So, yeah. Yeah, I think that's... And the look was very curated. You know, there was a particular thing she would wear and stuff she wouldn't. You know, that was definitely part of it. And you know...
Curated by whom?
It was initiated by Addison Creswell, actually, because he got me in a headlock, as he does. And it was when we were, like, getting ready to do stand-up for the week, and he was like, I want you to be that sort of Hackney girl. Yeah, like, really sassy and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, I'm not from Hackney, Addison, you're choking me. I'm from Newham. but I got where he was coming from, and... you know, we had a stylist in, and I'm not saying in any way, shape or form, he made me do it. You know, it wasn't that at all. He saw something that was going to work. So it was completely authentic at that time. Do you know what I mean? That was who I was.
Was it?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I did it, and it felt right. I never felt like, I never Got looked it. Down at my clothes or what I was saying, or just like, who are you, you monster? You know,
It wasn't a decision that you'd have gone in with.
No, but I liked it. You know, there was definitely, because I suppose maybe I was channeling a part of who I am, but don't we all, you know, when we're on stage performing, you know, especially if it's an authentic performance, you're still channeling a part of you, but it's not all of you.
Yeah.
There's parts of you that people don't experience or don't know about or whatever, but there's, so that performance, those performances were channeling a part of me.
100%.
Yeah.
And just to get across the visual element for people who haven't seen it, you dressed like, and you looked like a warrior. Do you know what I mean?
God,
you looked like a, you know, I mean, the streak in your hair.
Yeah, gosh.
I'm so jealous of your hair. I like big hair. Big hair, big streak, like an inventive streak in the hair. Like when you say stylist, it doesn't bat an eyelid for me, because I'm like, of course.
I didn't
think you had a stylist, but it completely makes sense that you did, because there were some big choices.
Yeah.
And you looked powerful.
Wow, okay.
And you walked out and people went nuts. You can see it now on all of those videos. You walking out, you're one of the few acts that it makes sense for the backdrop to lift up and there be smoke. Do you know what I mean? It's like, if Gary Delaney wanders out, yeah, sure, he's an incredible comic, but
right,
you know, and I'm sure he would say this himself, he's just a bloke in a whatever he's wearing, in a suit.
Right.
You walk out and you're like, fucking right, there's smoke.
Yeah, right, okay. Gosh, yeah. I mean... I wasn't thinking with that in mind, but yes, I suppose in hindsight, seeing it was like the look did lend itself to the occasion. because it was big, you know, Stand Up for the Week and Michael McIntyre's Roadshow and Apollo and stuff like that. So they're big sort of marquee shows. So and it was all the same producer. So they had that sort of that look, you know, with their shows.
Yep.
So I kind of fitted what I was doing, fitted in with that.
Yeah. And it also was something that no one else was doing or had done.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you were the first person that did that. I don't know if anyone's done that since. Hit that note of that amount of the, I mean, it's really interesting looking at the comments underneath someone's YouTube, which I don't know whether you've done or
not. No, I don't. No, so this is going to be news.
So the comments are, she's really funny. Legs. She's really funny. Whoa, those legs. She's really funny. Have you seen the legs?
Okay, right. And
to be fair, I guess you're such a powerful person. They're kind of respectful, if that is a thing.
Right.
They're kind of respectful. No one's going like, no, I'm not going to do an impression of someone saying something awful. But they're kind of like, you know, it's, you get the impression it's lots of keyboard men reeling, going, holy shit. They're not saying grubby things.
Depending
on where you kind of place that. But they are kind of in awe.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, there was a bit of that. Not a huge amount. I mean, but then again, I wasn't reading comments and things like that. And maybe people close to me knew a certain amount of, like, putting on of the character sort of thing, and see me outside of that, because that wasn't who I was being day to day sort of thing, you know. But yeah, definitely. Yeah, like from that point of stepping on stage, once the heels were on, I think, yeah, definitely there's a sort of, you're coming into alignment with something so that through you something can be expressed and that character is fully realised. Do you know what I mean? Does that make sense?
100%, yeah, 100%, absolutely. Yeah. And that's, I mean, you're very articulate about that and the nature of kind of character. You're from a theatrical background.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. So I started, I used to work in post-production, actually. I, you know, did that for 10 years.
Explain what post-production
is. So post-production is everything that happens once the show's been shot. So it's the editing, it's the making the sound lovely, might be effects work that's done. Loads of processes have to happen once the show's been shot. And so I worked in the sort of operational side of it. So I helped to organise all those different processes to make sure that the show got completed and delivered to the broadcaster in the form that they wanted it. And so I did that for about 10 years in various different areas, various different ways. And then I just got to the point where I was working on a soap that's no longer with us, Night and Day, the weirdest soap on television.
I don't think I've even heard of it.
Exactly.
What was the premise?
It started off with these two mothers whose daughters got swapped somehow at birth.
Okay.
But they were only discovering it like 16 years after it had happened or something like that. And it just got weirder and weirder and weirder. And it was on at 5:30 and ITV pulled it because it was too weird. Okay. And they replaced it with Crossroads. So, which is the right thing to do. And then, yeah, so I was actually on site with the production side of that soap, doing my post-production bit and getting to know the actors. And I was just like, as time went on, I was just like, I want to see what they're doing. You know, and I was like watching it.
That was the first time you had that thought?
Well, it had been with me a long time, but that was the first time that I thought, I'm going to do something about this. Because before, like, I went to college and Idris Elba was there when I was at college and all kinds of people that have gone on to do amazing things, but it never occurred to me that I could follow that path. So that's why I went to Ravensbourne College and studied whatever I had to be.
What's the significance of Ravensbourne?
So Ravensbourne is like, it's probably one of the best sort of design and media training grounds, basically, in the UK. And so at the time, there were very few people doing their sort of TV making and operations program. So I somehow got myself onto that. And I decided, all right, fine, I'll be in the background sort of thing. I'll be behind the camera doing something there. And it ended up being post-production. And then, you know, roll forward 10 years. And I'm just like, I really enjoyed my job. And it appealed to a certain part of me. But there was always a part of me that was hungry. And that this, knowing that this would never satiate it would never be satisfied with just spreadsheets and organizing other people's creativity. So, yeah.
Okay. So you went from there into theatre making?
Yeah, so I did a little sort of yeah, acting training. And then I thought, let me make my work, my acting work, if I can get it, I'll make it an apprenticeship. So every job I'll just absorb as much as I can, because I felt like I didn't have the time to go to drama school, you know, really commit to a sort of RADA 3 years, da, 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 all this sort of thing. So I thought, let me just get started and treat the whole thing as a, you know, as an apprenticeship. Of course, the way my mind was built, I just felt like a complete charlatan, like, for the whole time. So whenever people, and, you know, new actors are always talking about drama school, so whenever they had that conversation, I would literally just climb into a hole and just like, oh, okay, look, you know, and try and change the subject or something, or, yeah, it was awful. It was awful because I really wanted to do it, but I was just so consumed with this idea that I wasn't supposed to be there because I hadn't done the proper training.
I imagine they'd have felt the same. If you dropped it, well, I've been working in post-production, they'd all have been like, oh, fuck, what is that? What is that? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
do
you
think
you they know, would have been... I didn't even think of that. I just utterly was overwhelmed by the fact that they all knew about drama school and loads of different plays and loads of different directors and production companies, and they were just
And they're
of
constantly dropping those things to each other to affirm themselves and go, hey, we're all in it. Yeah, I get it, right? I get it.
Exactly.
Minter, sure,
yeah, yeah, yeah. And I'm like, yeah, I love Minter or whatever his name is. Yeah, just Harold Minter. So yeah, so there was a lot of that. And what was interesting about stand-up, which came to me partly out of necessity, was that it somehow gave me the, I don't want to say validation, but it's made me much more comfortable as an actor now, because I feel like I've done my time. It might not have been in the halls of RADA, but I've done my time now. So now I feel fully... you know, I'm not distracted by this sort of charlatan issue anymore because, yeah.
Yeah, you've done road miles that actors haven't.
Right.
Yeah, mate, we can all pretend to be a tree.
Yeah.
And I did a postgrad acting course, so I know what it's like in a drama school.
Right,
and
yeah,
you do pretend to be a tree, and that is valid and it has its own... Do you know what I mean? That's a thing.
Yeah.
But I completely can see how... That is a bad... You know, road miles are like a hard-won thing.
Right.
Dying on your ass in... Falmouth is, I've got a show coming up there. It's going to go really well. Don't know why I reached for Falmouth. But yeah, that's, you know, that gives you a sort of like an inner confidence.
Yeah. Yeah. It quietens something and invalidates that sort of, that voice in you that tells you you're not good enough.
How long was there a voice telling you you weren't good enough?
I mean, it's always there, Stuart. But it quietened down quite a lot during the stand-up time. So the question is... say the question again so that I know that I'm saying the truth.
Okay. That you mentioned in passing to the voice inside. You once you'd done the stand-up stuff, it quietened the voice inside that said you're not good enough.
Mm.
And... I'd like to talk to you about where that voice came from. How long, when were you first aware of it? How long was it? I have one of those.
Yeah,
it's a preoccupation. This is the right podcast on which to talk about it.
Excellent.
I felt I saw you make a choice there. Or, you know, be at the threshold. How deep should we go? Deep as you're happy.
Okay, yeah, no, because I can feel that I could cry, but equally, like, we could say something funny. So I think the reason that I wanted to just make sure I'm telling the truth is that I think the truth is it's always there. You know, it never really goes. It's just your relationship with it can change. And sometimes it does get a hold of you and sometimes it doesn't. But, you know, those early days of acting, it just had a hold of me all the time, pretty much all the time. Everything was a trigger for it.
Was it there in the... Thank you. And same here. did it exist when you were doing post-production stuff?
Oh, that's interesting. No, I was quite arrogant then, actually, because I was just sort of bumbling along. It's like, again, sort of talking about like different versions of myself, but it feels like that was such a different time. I didn't really think about whether I was good or not.
That's interesting.
Because I was just, it was just a job.
Yeah, it's a series of tasks. You complete the tasks, job done.
Yeah.
And then moving into acting or the creative arts, you sort of go, oh, never job done. Because, you know, there's no brief. There's no measurable targets. It's out there. There's a thing now. How will I know if I've done my job?
Yeah. I ironically, sorry, just as you were saying that, you just made me realise as well, though, that, you know, with a bit of perspective, I look back on those post-production days and go, oh, for a lot of the time, I was not very good at my job. Like, I could see that now because I was quite lazy. You know, I did the bare minimum. You know, I didn't...
But you were happy, were you? Were you happy?
Oh, well, that's another question. Was I happy with the job? Yes, I was happy I had a job. Yes, I enjoyed my colleagues and stuff. Yeah. But was I happy? No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I don't, you know, I mean, that's another question, really, because that's more like I had therapy and all that sort of caper. So I had to do all of that stuff. I was quite a sort of troubled person, like up until I'd say probably mid-30s. Yeah, so for quite a while, quite a lot of my life, I was just like, like I was fun to be out with, you know what I mean? I was one of those people that they're fun as long as they haven't had too much to drink. And then they're like, okay. Oh, my dad left when I was 7 and I haven't reconciled it still. You know, so you know, there was a lot of that.
Okay. I'm assuming that the dad leaving when you were 7 is not just improv. That's like a thing.
No, that's
in your
that's,
life.
And that's
that would be your track. That would be where you'd go when you'd had one too many.
Yeah, especially at that point because I had made no sense of it.
Sure.
I had made no sense of it.
Do you think, as a sort of tangential question, do you think that people's brains are like they are one way or another? Do you think that, hypothetically, had your dad not left, you would have had the same questions about self and identity, but you'd have hung them on something else?
Stuart, I think that is a very, very smart thing to say because I think that's exactly how it works. I pretty much believe this wholeheartedly that, you know, the how human beings come into being, the mechanism of it is the same pretty much for everyone. And at some point you will develop a personality. At some point you will find what your hang-ups are going to be. And you take, you know, whatever stimulus is presented is what becomes the shaping, as it were, of that personality. And you might have a breakdown at some point. You know what I mean? Like there's just like points in the road that we, you know, as a species tend to go through. And so, yeah, you're right. If it hadn't have been that, I would have found something else probably. But that was the thing. That was the one that happened in my life.
Do you ever find I sometimes notice a new hang up develop? Do you ever have that? I have a thought and then I think, oh fuck, I'm going to think of it like that forever now. So this is Andy, and I mean, she's so warm and funny and very, very honest and open-hearted, and that's what we like here on the show. So thank you once again to her for coming along. Thanks, of course, to everyone at the Bill Murray at Angel, Angel Comedy, who very kindly let us meet there to record. I won't go too much into the content of this episode. I will tell you that if you join the Insiders Club, you can get over 20 minutes of extras from this one. Andy goes into a lot of detail on some of the courses that she's been on. We talk about the context of personality and how oneself is more than one's personality. We talk about ontological studies. And we talk about the Concord Institute and some of the brain training and the meditation that she's got into as she has continued her journey into understanding herself, I guess. We talk a bit about stage personas and how they're really a mask. We talk a lot about personal development we talk about sensitivity, words, and the desire to be educated. And I think the way the editors worked in the extras, you will hear me talk to her about the word warrior, which I said to her earlier on. I think you've got to be careful about likening a black woman to a warrior. But I equally think, you know, we talk about it in the moment if you hear the extras. But I also think that I can stand by that if you just take one look at one of her appearances on Live at the Apollo. She's extraordinarily physically striking and powerful. So I don't think I'm falling into too much of a sort of pale male stale trap there, to use that analogy. So
There is all of that stuff available at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. Please join up there. The minimum donation is currently only £2 a month, but that is set to go up later in the year. So it's a good time to join now at £2 a month and get grandfathered in, as they say. That's all of that. Listen, there's loads of stuff to talk to you about. I will mention Soho briefly. I think... Did I speak about this last week? I can't remember. I've had a holiday week, and I will tell you in the postamble the four things that went wrong on my holiday. For now, a very quick shout-out to anyone going up to the Edinburgh Festival. If you'd like to join the ComCom Facebook group, search for Comedians Comedian Facebook group on podcast. It remains one of the nicest, warmest, and most pleasant and well-regulated corners of the internet. And as we start to all get giddy together about the impending Edinburgh Festival, there will be lots of... suggestions for shows on there. People are sharing tips. People are. It'll be spreadsheet day before you know it, where we all geekily post our spreadsheets of all the shows we're going to go and see. Which, if you are new to the festival or making your first visit this year, I highly recommend just kind of hijacking spreadsheet day, or what's the word? Piggybacking spreadsheet day, in order to find. Like, not just to see the level of organisation, the extraordinary planning which is possible, but also if you are about to go to the festival and fear you may be out of your depth, I mean, as a listener to this show, I think you've got a pretty good grounding in who to go and see. But I think, actually, a really simple way to do a first hit and run, and tell me if anyone's ever done this in the past, I've always thought this would be a good idea, get on the Facebook group or follow me on Twitter at ComComPod, and when we do spreadsheet day, I will retweet and we'll post everyone's spreadsheets about their shows and just jump on and go, yeah, I'm having that, and just copy someone's day and see if you can keep up with the most rabid ComCompletist and their extraordinary stamina and schedule. There's going to be some special events coming up at this year's Edinburgh Festival as well for members of the Insiders Club, and if you're in the Facebook group, then that will be the first port of call for... Once all the insiders tickets have gone out, then I will then, you know, once as many insiders are on board as can make it, then I'll make things available next to the Facebook group. So always a good idea to join up to that. What else? I feel like there's one. Oh, yeah. And come and see my show. Come and see my show, Primer, at the Edinburgh Festival at Monkey Barrel at 3 p.m. daily. There's two consecutive days off in the middle of the month whilst I go home to clutch my children to me and attempt to clutch my children to me as they variously go, get off, and throw tantrums at me. So more stuff in a postamble coming up. Let's get back now to this conversation with Andy Osho.
Small details are big surfaces, tight corners are odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you were to give advice to someone who is currently in that kind of mode, being successful, not completely... not feeling completely consistent that their stand-up persona represents them and what they want to achieve. Is there any way you could advise someone to tweak what they're doing short of going stop and have a break?
Right, yeah. Well, it depends. Are you saying that this hypothetical person is unhappy?
Well, I'm saying this this hypothetical person is who you were in 2012 on stage, crushing gigs, but not being sure that it was... Is that, have I understood that right? You were doing well, big TV, big presence, but you now can look back and go, I don't think I was being honest in what I was doing.
If we're talking about, if the hypothetical person is actually me, then I'd say then you, yes, you had to take a break. You had to stop.
Sure.
But if it was someone who was feeling like they feel like there's a bit of a gap between who they are and what they're doing on stage, I would just say never feel like you have to do what other people tell you you should want. Because I think that I felt victim of that in a way. And not because that's not other people's fault. That's because I didn't listen to myself for quite a long time, or didn't listen to the sort of warning signs or whatever in terms of how I was feeling. But
what sort of warning signs do you mean?
Well, just how unhappy I was, I suppose, okay. Really. And, you know, particularly with comedy, I think that at that time, there was a very clear narrative of what comedians thought comedians should want. And so when you are offered those things, I didn't feel as though there was any choice. I didn't even think about a choice. I thought, right, that's what I do now. If that's been offered, that's what I do. You know, I never thought, is there an artist in here desperate to express themselves? I was just like, oh, I got offered that. I have to do that. And then that will lead to that. And everybody wants to tour and everybody wants to do da 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 da, right? And so I would do these things. But actually, I think if I was to say anything to anyone who was new to the industry or in the middle of a sort of crisis or whatever in their sort of creative careers, it would be do what you feel you are called to do next, and never buy into a narrative that's been prescribed by other people in the industry. Because a lot of the time that's coming from their own stories, their own inadequacies, hang-ups, you know, personal desires or whatever. They're nothing to do with you. You know, like, there's so many people in this industry that haven't followed a particular path that have succeeded. So why are we all telling each other that there's only one way of doing it? And in hindsight, in a way, the path that was available was not very exciting to me. It felt quite limited. I think there's more scope now for people who come through stand-up. But at the time, it felt very limited.
What did you foresee that path was?
Well,
if you kept
me, one of seven, some studio somewhere, 3-hour records. Next, me, one of seven, fighting for their 3.5 minutes of screen time, sitting down. Like,
do you mean in a panel show?
Yeah,
it's
the song. Yeah, because at that time there was a lot of throwing panel show ideas. Because I did loads of like little pilot thingies where people are testing out game show ideas, and it's like, you know what I mean? Like, they're just one after another of them trying to, because they're quite cheap formats, aren't they? So, like, okay, guys, we're all animals, yeah, and the point of the game is, you know, that type of stuff. And you're just like, oh, God, again? And, like, there's a part of me is just like, God, I want this to be over. And part of me is just like, give me the money sort of thing. So, yeah, I think that, yeah, I don't wish it were any other way. But were I to do it again, I think I would just... Actually, I can't say definitely that I would have just stuck to the stand-up, because it you know, it benefited me in many, many ways. So, I, you know, there's things I wouldn't have now if I hadn't have been through that. So I can't even say, oh, if I did it again, I'd only do stand-up, I wouldn't do the panel shows. Panel shows gave me a huge amount, and I'm massively, massively grateful for Mock the Week were the first people to take a punt on me, and I will never forget that, you know, and never forget the fact that they backed me on the ones where I wasn't very good and backed me on the ones where I was good. So, you know, I owe them, and I would never, yeah, I don't want to sound ungrateful of that time, but yeah, there were some shit formats that people came up with, you know.
So when you first went to LA, were you still in stand-up mode? Were you thinking, I'm going to go to LA and be a stand-up?
I was thinking, I'm going to go to LA and transition. So I was still doing stand-up when I got out there. When I met with management, I was telling them, like, I'm letting this go, but I am still doing stand-up. But I could see that it could facilitate something over there.
Okay, because you were going over for what, for pilot season?
Yeah, I went, like, uninvited. I went for pilot, no one was, like, expecting me.
But I don't think anyone's invited to pilot season.
Well, some people
they
are.
They've not just put up a flare and it was like, there it is!
I'm off. Yeah. I think what I'm saying is I went speculatively rather than that there was something on the horizon or whatever. What was I saying?
You were there transitioning out of stand-up.
Yeah, that's right.
But
yeah.
Not you. I'm presumably having meetings where you were going, "Hey, I'm a stand-up. Here's a load of proof that I'm a really good stand-up. But I'd really much rather be doing this."
Yeah.
But I would imagine stand-up gives you an edge over the next 10 sitcom actors.
Sure, exactly.
Sure.
Exactly. And also, yeah, I mean, precisely that, because I kept doing it because I knew strategically it would be useful. And, you know, I was showing promoters my clips of, you know, Live at the Apollo, just showing them something of scale, do you know what I mean? That would make them just go, oh, okay, she's not just some chancer sort of thing.
I guess in the States there's far fewer huge rooms like that. You know, most stand-up clips are on late-night TV shows. We've only got, like, 60, 100 people in the audience.
Yeah, yeah. Or it's people's specials, as they call them now. So, it was a bit of that. So I just wanted to show them that there is, hopefully they would consider me to have a bit of caliber behind me. Made no difference.
Yeah,
it was really hard. Yeah. Because like, you just think this is going to get me a gig, right? Like I'm showing like this, the smoke, you know, like, I mean, come on. But yeah, it was actually because LA is not a place where you go to make it as a comedian. LA is where you go to get, you've really established yourself somewhere else, and then you come here and it happens.
You've made all your mistakes somewhere else. You arrive as a fully formed package, and then,
right? And probably you've got management, and they know where they're going to put you, and that's the game. Whereas you know, I was starting from almost pretty much a standing start without the management to really back me on that front. So yeah, it was. And what happened was I was just finding it harder and harder to find gigs, and the ones that I was doing, they were like open mics where there was like 40 comedians who name goes into a hat. Have you done any gigs in LA? So you know the ones I'm talking about, you know, 40 names into a hat, and the names get pulled out, and you know, if you're sort of comedian number 5, fantastic. You've got all the other comedians who are waiting. You know, maybe the first two hang around to...
It's like the London Open Mic Circuit in, like, cubed, isn't it?
But yes, exactly.
Sure.
And then, but if you're comedian 36, every fucker's gone. You know what I mean? So you're playing a room to... You're playing to 5 angry comedians who just want to get on and pissed off that everybody else overran. So it's kind of like... There's only so many of those you can do. And you know, I don't want to be like arrogant about it, like I've done Live at the Apollo or whatever, but you just think, fuck, does that count for nothing in this town?
So what, for those people who do arrive as a fully formed thing, as the package with the management, I guess they don't have to do that because they built up their profile in the States and so they're already a headliner.
That's right, yeah, I think that's the case. And, you know, maybe their management can get them onto those good shows as well, because there was one point when I did get my... I got new management and I got them involved and they started to get me sort of nicer gigs. But also in LA, those rooms that we take for granted over here, they're quite few and far between. Like, nice rooms that pay a decent amount of money, they're not... I don't know that there's even that many of them in LA. Like, you know, I did a laugh factory something or other, and I went home with a princely sum of like $13 or something, and it was just like, the fuck is this? You know what I mean, you know that there are rooms in the UK that people live off this, you know, what they can generate on the UK circuit. They send their kids to private school, and there you can barely feed yourself, you know, off the US, LA stand-up scene anyways. So I just, over time, I was just like, I'm done.
How long did that? I mean, you were planning to transition out of it anyway.
Yeah.
But maybe you were expecting to sort of just be like the wave going into shore, just like on the surf, on the wave, and I'm down.
Yeah.
And it wasn't quite like that.
Yeah, it was more of a shelf, more of a tsunami shelf I just fell off of. I just had a word with myself because I thought, you've started again many times, Osho. You've done that. You started again after post-production. You did it after acting. And, you know, you've done it as a, you know, bringing writing in as well. So you're used to starting from the ground floor and building something. Why don't you want to do it now? And I realized that I'd kind of fallen out of love with the business as well as everything else that was going on, being depressed and, you know, all that stuff. So I realized that this particular manifestation of me as a comedian might be done. Like the business had got the better of me in a way.
Is it harder or easier to be depressed in LA than London?
Don't know. It wasn't great anyway. So, yeah, I think in LA, I think what I found difficult in LA was that I felt as though I was supposed to be there, but I didn't know why. I really did feel like I was supposed to be there. And I thought, God, it would be so easy if I instinctively felt like I should just go home. But I just didn't feel like that. So I was in this weird place, and it is a weird place, not in the ways that people think, that it's not like in the stereotypical, you know, ways, but it is a strange, energetically, it's just very removed from London. And no one gave a crap that I was there, really, because I, you know, apart from my management, but no, I hadn't made any fans of the industry, as they say. So my being there was largely irrelevant. And yet I still felt like I should be there. And so that was a strange time, a strange sort of paradoxical time of like thinking it would be easier if I went home, but feeling like I shouldn't. And not knowing what I should be doing.
Why? Where now, where do you think that feeling came from that you should be there?
I can't say I actually really know. I don't doubt it now, even with hindsight, but what I think it might have been is it might have been a regrouping. It might have been about recalibrating, because I come back now with a different sense of myself and what I want to achieve and what I'm capable of. And, you know, that voice that we're talking about, the one that says you're not good enough, doesn't have such a purchase anymore. And that's come from being in probably the toughest part of the entertainment industry, because it's just because of pure competition. And in LA, the entertainment business feels much more like a business. It feels like show business, you know, big letters. Whereas here it's sort of show play almost. Like we're kind of, comparatively, it feels like we're larking about over here. Because it's getting, I can feel the businessness of it coming because of, you know, collaborations with US, you know, businesses and talent and stuff like that. But in production companies. But yeah, it really is a business. And even creatives are like super, super pro compared to us. Like, you know, when you're in a green room in LA, I don't know if you found the same thing, but I just noticed how businessy like every conversation is. It's like when you go into the Comedy Store in London, people are talking about their kids and, you know.
A-Roads.
Exactly. Whereas in LA, they're like, hey, man, yeah, I saw that your book just came out. That's awesome news. And did you hear about da-da-da? They're producing it, blah, 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 blah. And it's business, business, business. And I just couldn't connect with that. I couldn't connect with other comedians because it's just like, who gives a fuck? I need to know which A-Road you took to get here. You know, like, how are your kids? I just literally don't care about that guy's got a book out. It's like...
Did you join in and pretend
to? No, I completely... Because what I wanted to do is just be almost silent in the dressing room and then be fucking awesome on stage. So they're like, whoa, I thought she was going to tank or something. I don't know, or whatever they might have been thinking about me. And then I'll just go and just like torpedo the room.
And did you?
Yes. Sometimes. Yeah. I mean, that, you know, being black and you know, British is a charm that beguiles them and confuses them at the same time. So it's sort of... It's almost like it's not fair.
You mean it's like they rolled over for you sometimes?
No, I don't. I would. I still had to work for it, but it is just. It's just odd. It's just unusual, and not so much now because, you know, obviously there's a lot more black talent in the States in the entertainment industry than there used to be. But you know, at the time it was just. You know, there was a handful of people, and certainly not on the comedy circuit. There was, you know, not really any talent that they...
Gina, right?
And that's it, right?
That's it,
so
yeah.
There's two people, basically. So, yeah, I can't think of any other Brits that were there sort of regularly handling it.
And in terms of community, in terms of, like, did you stay in touch with comics that you were mates with in the UK? Or had you kind of isolated yourself...
I saw a couple, but yeah, I mean, yeah, I didn't feel part of a community. I didn't feel like, because there's a lot of movement like between the two countries of like talent backwards and forwards in all industries. And I didn't feel particularly part of that community, maybe because I was still in something. I don't really know why that was, but I didn't really, maybe because I was sort of, yeah, trying to squirrel myself away and just like, maybe I was cocooned. Waiting hopefully one day that I might at least have one butterfly wing or something, maybe two, but yeah.
And how did it go in terms of booking TV shows in America?
Well, it started all right, and but I never really got traction. So, you know, I'd get a pilot, but then the character would only be in that one episode. Or, you know, I did some late night talk shows and, you know, got into conversations with production companies about stuff, but it never really went anywhere. And so it was all fits and starts the whole time I was there. And I think that by the time I got into more recently, I just thought to myself, I need to up my game in terms of who my management is. And until that happens, I don't think I can do there what I really would like to. It's time to come home. And so that was a very logical series of sort of thoughts and insights, I suppose, that I got about how the industry works there, who I am in it, what's possible out of all of that, and therefore what action needs to be taken. And I think that sort of growth period had, for the time being, concluded as well. So it was time to come home. And it's not like I was there consistently the whole 6 years. I was backwards and forwards. You know, I shot Curfew for Sky One, you know, for 5 months last year. And I'd be, you know, backwards and forwards doing Super Shoppers, and which is a consumer affairs show I did for Channel 4. And you're smiling. You can ask me about that. Yep. So, you know, it wasn't like I was there consistently, but I felt like it was time to for my orientation, you know, that for that to be the UK again.
And so are you currently UK based, or are you hopping back and forth?
Yeah, I still have a place over there, but the intention is to be here more. But, you know, what was really useful about being there was like understanding how it works, so that when I do, or if I do end up working there again, I've had like so much experience of just, you know, even just basic stuff like knowing the lay of the land, knowing how the industry is structured over there, knowing a few who, you know, key figures, being members of, you know, Film Independent and BAFTA. LA and stuff like that. You know what I mean? Like, so I've gotten a certain degree of foundation set up over there, so that when I do go back, if I do go back, that this I'm hitting the ground running, basically.
Tell me about Curfew.
So yeah, this is something that I shot for Sky One last year, 2018. So they're just putting on the finishing touches, and it's out on Friday. So it's basically about this illegal sort of street race thing, where if you win, you get like helicoptered out. It's weird, right? You get helicoptered out of the UK to an island, because, you know, Britain has been overrun by this virus that's infecting people.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Yeah, we should have opened right? with virus. Post-apocalyptic, right? Okay.
It's not post-apocalyptic. It's a sort of parallel alternative present.
Okay, yes. Sci-fi?
I guess so.
Kind of sci-fi.
Kind of. You know what? It's such a mashup. It's got a bit of everything. It's got, you know, drama, comedy. It's funny. And then it's got this, you know, kind of sci-fi aspect to it. Then it's got the race. So, okay. Yeah.
And what's your role within it?
So my kid, I've got two kids, and my son does something he shouldn't have, which means that my husband, Adrian Lester, fabulous, he decides that the only course of action, or the best course of action for us, is to enter the race. And I'm like, hell to the no. Like, I like the curfew. Like, my characters are just like, we're safe. But he says, no, we got to enter the race. And that's kind of where our story as a family begins.
So this is... this is quite uncharted territory for me, because I normally talk to people about the stuff they've created,
yeah,
about which they can be searingly honest about the highs and lows of it, right?
Right?
Because we're in kind of slightly more promotional territory, this
right.
is a thing, and it's not like you're in it, but it's not your baby.
Yeah.
Like, what can we discover about the process for you? Did you feel grounded and happy in making this?
Well, I tell you what it does link to is this thing that we were saying about feeling good enough and stuff like that. So, you know, taking on a character over the course of, you know, a number of episodes is very different from all the other acting experiences that I've had. But I, you know, I just really enjoyed getting under somebody else's skin. And it's almost like a detective job, really, of like figuring out, why is this person the way they are? Why are they saying... If I take what's written in the script, what clue does that give me about who this person is? So in terms of an acting process, it was so... It's so much... I mean, obviously, it's the dream to get a regular role in something, or a lead role in something, but it really is so rewarding to, like, really get into one character and just be with them and figure them out and be them and be honestly them, you know, because you can manufacture certain moments, certain scenes if you're not feeling it. But the real, the juicy, yummy bit is when you go, yeah, I'm actually completely connected with that experience, with that character. I'm drawing on something that happened to me and using it in that moment. And so I'm creating that moment honestly.
And is your acting craft, is it DIY? Is it apprenticeship based, given that you didn't go to drama school?
Yeah, so now, so yes. And also I did a really fabulous course in LA with this acting coach, Howard Fine, who, you know, he's worked with, you know, Bradley Cooper and Jared Leto and people like that. And his training was exactly what I needed. The first time I encountered it, I felt like it was too big for me. I felt like I would get swallowed up by it because I wasn't ready to, you know, take on training. It's just so rigorous. And
what kind of thing are you talking, like,
it's not
Eastern
being a
European
tree.
Clown training, yeah, right, shaving, yeah, your head and running in the snow, right. What kind of thing are we talking about?
But it's just you know, a lot of times with a lot of creative things, people try and bullshit their way through it, and he was not taking that. Basically he's asking for absolute authenticity, and if you try and wing it, he'll call you on it. And so you can't cute your way through this training. That's the best way I can describe it, really. And it's like, you know, when someone's got their little tricks and their tools that they use, and we have it in stand-up and all kinds of, you know, creative expressions where you just like, oh, this will get me through this. I don't have to phone it in a bit or whatever. He won't take that. And so I didn't feel like I was ready to be, you know, to have that rigor imposed on me. But then when I was, I think it's some of the best training I've had, because, and I was ready for it. I don't think I would have even been able to properly hear it if I'd done it maybe 10 or when I first started acting. So it came at just the right time, probably been in LA a couple of years. So I'd sort of got the lay of the land and realized that you got to up your game in terms of acting. You've really got to bring, you can be a good actor, or if you want to be a great actor, you've got to bring a level of authenticity and, you know, spontaneity and presence that people who are trying to manufacture a performance, they're not going to be able to do, because they're kind of trying to curate it and pre-shape it. Decide, oh, in this moment I'm going to do a little look, and then I'm going to, you know, when people shape a performance like that, you can tell it's inauthentic because they're not spontaneously in the moment with the person that they're with, as real people do in a conversation.
I'm really interested in that idea of authenticity, because that, I think that has parallels with good comedy.
Right.
When you get the sense that, oh, this person isn't... You can always see it when someone has made a decision about, now I'm going to go like this to show that I'm like that. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, completely. Completely.
So if you were to return to stand-up, would you be able to find that authenticity going back?
The only reason I would return to stand-up. You know, I was saying to someone earlier that it's almost like a pebble in my shoe, but in a good way, of like something's calling me back. And the only thing I know that it must be on my terms, and my terms were, I realize now, always about the craft of it. It was always about pure stand-up. That's what I loved. That's what I love. And so if I went back, it would be about the authenticity. And I wouldn't care about getting onto any, this is what's great, because I've done all that stuff. I wouldn't care about trying to get anywhere.
You could do one of those Rob Newman pivots.
Right. Like, well, not that political, but...
No, sure, but I've already done Wembley. Yeah, like, what do I actually give a fuck about?
Yeah, right.
I'm putting words in his mouth there. I've not had him on the show.
But I think that's how he feels. And my commitment would still obviously be about funny, but you know, it just takes that clawing desperation of I hope that a producer's in the back of the roomness out of the whole thing.
Can you see that desperation when you look at old Andy Osho?
Let's see.
Tell
you what I can see is more of a fear of like me. I want you all to like me, you know? And it's not like I'm about to create some monster or something that like doesn't give a fuck about what people think, but it's more like because I'm not trying to get anywhere. I don't want anything from you just for you to be able to enjoy this. I want to share this with you. That's all I'll be wanting. So it just unburdens you of certain responsibilities. You know what I mean? Like you're not trying to shape a career here.
Are you happy?
Yeah, I'm much happier than I used to be. I think that I'm learning that depressive energy belongs in my space somehow, you know. So I say it like that really specifically because not because I don't want to call it depression, but I want to relate to it more like that. Like it's just an energy. It's just part of my. It's just an energy that's part of who I am, and sometimes I'm more in that than others. But for the most part, I'm much happier than I used to be. I think there's a sort of a settledness, you know, about me now internally that I didn't have before. But I also feel like there's a bit more work to do in terms of just being comfortable in my own skin and just kind of being more present, basically, you know, just letting each day unfold for what it is and detaching just ever so from trying to get somewhere. Because sometimes I try and vacate the present moment by having fantasies of how life might turn out and how maybe one day there will be a partner and maybe there'll be a house and a dog. I love cats. But, you know, the present moment is all we really have. And so the more you can really comfortably tolerate that space and whatever is really in that space, then you will be, quote unquote, happy, I think.
If you could, via the use of some sort of magic tunnel through time, if you had the opportunity to say one thing, like you had 1 minute to peer through time and talk to your younger self.
Oh, wow.
And you had and it was about happiness. It was about getting all the things you've learned. What's the one thing that you would try and pass to younger you to try and...
So I can go back at any time.
Yeah, you can pick a time. Pick a time and you've got 2 minutes to get across the central, like the most valuable lesson that you have learned in the last, since however long.
Oh, gosh, I think it's going to be a bit worthy, but I'd probably go back to sometime around 10 or something like that. And I would tell myself something along the lines of, you're fine, you know, you don't keep this ember going because this is who you are. And no matter what happens around you, no matter what people try and tell you, this is who you are. And then I would disappear and she would be totally freaked out.
So that was Andy. Thank you once again to her for coming along. Really, really enjoyed that conversation. And as I said, I'm very, very grateful to her for being so upfront and so candid about the personal development journey that she's been on. I think it's very interesting, fascinating to hear someone who had a lot of the things that I suppose people in certain early phases of their career, we all know open mics who would give their right arm to go, oh, here's all my clips, here's my appearances on this, that and the other. And actually, I think it shows a remarkable strength of character for Andy to have put the brakes on and gone, actually, I might appear to be having it all here, but this isn't what I want. So it puts me in mind a little bit of friend of the podcast and someone I'm always trying to convince to come on the show, Joe Wilkinson. Joe and I started at a similar time, around the mid-2000s, and I remember being so impressed that he was doing really well, did well in competitions, and he just put the brakes on. He went, the direction that this is going in is not where I want to take it. He kind of circled back, had a bit of a break, and then became the Joe Wilkinson that, he's the same guy. But my point is, he was able to tap the tiller in quite a significant way. And I'm always impressed when people do that, when people have the self-confidence and the self-belief to seize control of what they're doing and change it, rather than feeling like the undertow, the drag of, well, this is happening now, that it has to go like that. This harks back a little bit, I think, to what I said at the end of last week's episode about change and about how we can all change and you don't have to stay anywhere forever, as they say. So thank you once again to Andy Osho. Thanks to Jake Crossland for logging this episode and reminding me that I haven't put it out yet. I'm so sorry. That's not happened in nearly 300 shows, and I'm terribly embarrassed. Thank you to Peter Dobbing, podcast consultant, Rob Smountain for the music, and of course Nathan Wood for his editing and uploading abilities. And I mean production. I keep saying editor and uploader. What I mean is production, producer Nathan Wood. There we are. Let's dignify Nathan with a proper title. There we go, mate. Follow me at ComComPod on Twitter or Instagram to be kept abreast of developments. And like I said, the Facebook group is a really good place to not just swap B memes while I'm out of the country for a week. Thank you, children, naughty children. But also to indulge in some quite, dare I say, high-level, respectful, intelligent, sophisticated comedy conversation. So join up there, and that'll be the second port of call after the Insiders Club for any new special things that are happening during Edinburgh. One more time, 20 minutes plus worth of extra stuff available from Andy at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. Now, I'm going to have a little post-amble at you in just a sec. And for that, I might go into a different room. Bye for now. So, hello. This is me post-ambling at you, and you'll notice the acoustic has changed radically. I'm in an incredibly echoey small room, which is a terrible place to record. I apologise. This is the only quiet corner I can find in the office. It occurs to me, if I could bring in a duvet, I could do one of my... I could bring in my box full of memory foam, couldn't I? And I could bring in my little recording studio. But even then, I'd be hard-pressed to deal with the amazing echo here. Here's a little post-amble at you about the ridiculous holiday we've just been on. And, God, what a week! What a week! We went to France with another family, and they're lovely, and their children are the same age as our children, and our toddlers are best pals at their childcare. So we had a lovely family holiday together. But a week before that, I broke my thumb. Did I tell you about this? I fell down the stairs like a little old man. You remember. Broke my thumb, had my thumb in a cast, had my whole thumb and wrist and most of my hand in a cast, and was sort of feeling pretty... it's just such a pain. It's such a pain physically, and such an inconvenience and a frustration to be trying to change nappies. So this is one element of it. Every single non-parent that I said this to said the same thing. The problem is, when you've got your hand in a cast, you can't risk getting matter on the cast. So when you change a nappy, you've got to do it one-handed or with an elbow, or often leave it to your partner and go, look, I've done a few of these, I can't do them today. So my wife ended up doing more than her fair share. Everyone I mentioned that to was like, oh God, it's a nightmare, I can't do nappies. They'd be like, hey, brilliant. And you go, no, you have no understanding of co-parental debt. I would much rather do the things. Is that a, I don't know, is that, it makes me think now that sometimes I rely on doing tasks. I think, is that a dad thing? I don't want to gender it unnecessarily, but there is a certain comfort to be found when parenting, when things are melting down all around you. And that's a whole other post-amble. Good Lord, the Boutros. I love that boy to bits, but he's been flipping out. He's been having a flip out with his lip out 6 times during a 2-hour shopping trip yesterday. Good Lord. Anyway, love him. There's a string to my bow regarding parenting and media that might be a thing, but I was about to tell you about it and I realised I can't yet because it doesn't technically exist. Doesn't matter. Tangents upon tangents, wheels within wheels. The point is that it's debt, right? It's better to do the tasks. When coping with a melting down child or a pair of children, a brace of young, There is a certain comfort to be found in just doing stuff. I think, if I'm honest, if I'm really honest, that is a, you know, that's a dad thing, isn't it? You go, and the reason it's a dad thing is because we've got less moral fibre, is the point I'm trying to make. Because you go, oh, right, don't, I'll get the car, I'll bring the car round. Because what that means is I'll go away and do something quasi-necessary, packing the car. There's a bit in End Of about how much I enjoy, how important it is to me to pack the car. And let's drill right down into that. To be honest, that's partly about having a task to do so that you can go and do your task, which is... Yes, my mother-in-law listens to this show religiously and pulls me up on all of the things in the post-ambles that I'm ashamed of. So apologies, Alan. It's true, and we'll have to chat about it. Yes, my mother-in-law's called Alan. Let's not dwell on that. Look, I was all over the place because I'd broken my thumb. And then we went on holiday. And then, okay, I had a thing. I can't remember the first part of the word for this. It's a medical term. It's in two words. The second word, syncope. What it is when little old men get up for a wee in the middle of the night and the resulting drop in blood pressure from being deeply asleep to being stood up, right? You know, just like getting up quickly. Getting up quickly and weeing is that even more so. And the deeper asleep you've been in, that extends it as well. And basically, that kind of head rush, whoa, faint thing. This little old men can faint sometimes. And it happened to me. I got up for a wee in the middle of the night on holiday and I fainted dead away. I did not pass out because I was drunk. I was very slightly drunk. But it was mostly me getting up for a wee in the middle of the night. And we were in this huge house that we'd rented and arguably far too big. And so I was kind of like down through a door and down some stairs and up some stairs and through another door, had a wee, just rocked backwards. I sort of don't remember it. I hazily remember in quite a fun kind of televisual kind of way, like just seeing the ceiling. And Jesus Christ, I just literally fell over backwards, like a prone fall. You know, like I might have mentioned, we learnt in circus school. I remember our clown teacher coming in one day and saying, right, today we're falling over. And so a prone fall is you just face the floor and put your hands down at the last minute, but you basically just go bang. Well, it was that backwards, and my head bashed on the lip of... Do I mean the lip, the bit of a shower that was behind the toilet? So the bit that stops the water coming out of the shower onto the floor, that bit, let's call it the lip. I just banged my head off that. Christ, can you think of anything more painful? And knocked myself unconscious. And suddenly awoke to me being, my wife ran over and was shaking me awake going, Jesus Christ. And doing that thing where someone is so worried for you that it's become their problem and now they're freaking out and you need to look after them. But I was in no position to look after her because I was in so much pain with my poor little broken thumb and I was just unconscious, like with my eyes open, staring. And she roused me. And then we had to sit and go, well, look, do we need to... Like, if we call an ambulance, we're 2 miles... Well, not 2 miles, we're 2 hours from Toulouse and we're in the middle of effing nowhere... So, for convenience sake, let's just hope I'm not dying. And we'll just monitor me. And then I was sick. And then with the next morning, we texted some GPs. Yeah, how middle class are we? We've got two friends who are both GPs. And those are our go-to. Those are our walking around GPs. There are probably some other GPs there as well. But... We texted both of these dear friends and they got back to us and said, look, well, if he hasn't been sick, it's fine. And we're like, no, he's been sick. Okay, well, it was probably the booze. Okay, fine. We've been eating lots of French cheese and rich food. So it was probably just that. Continue monitoring Stu and make sure he doesn't be sick again or pass out again or his head falls off. God, it was a scary night. And Christ, it hurt. Just remembering now... Bloody hell, that hurt. And then one of our household got very ill with what I shall refer to as a double ender and move on.
a 24-hour double-ender, and then that started working its way around the adults and children on the trip, and I got it on the travelling day home. So there's me with my neck very tender. I've got a huge bruise under my hair on the right side of my head, still now, very, very tender. You know, hand in cast, it's queasy as my wife tries to steer us all back through, you know, a hire car and then through a plane journey and then eventually getting home. What I'm saying is, I'm sorry if you're in Wokingham or Guildford. I didn't make those gigs. I planned in my hubris to get back to the UK at about 4, and then my friend was going to drive me, because I can't drive because of the broken thumb. My friend was going to drive me to the shows, and I thought, hey, this will be a breeze, and I absolutely failed, and I'm sorry. But my God, just piles upon things and things. And I missed a gig that I won't go into this in too much detail, just to say that there is an important and regular gig that I do and that I love doing. And they sent me the information on Wednesday lunchtime saying, right, we'll see you tomorrow on the Thursday. And I'm so glad I caught that email, because I had something in the email chain months ago had broken down, and I wasn't able to do a big important thing that I regularly do, and so I let all those people down, because for the want of an email ages ago, and I was like, well, I can't do this, I'm in France and I've just smashed my head. So all told, between the illness and the unconsciousness and the inability to help properly, and nearly, you know, making things super hard for a bunch of people I love working with very much, and nearly losing a really lovely regular thing. What a week. What a fucking week. And now I'm back, and I've got that post-holiday thing of the landslide of admin that even now, by talking to you in detail about everything going wrong, I am largely procrastinating from getting on with 3 significant things that I have to get done today. Oh, well, it felt good to get that off my chest. I don't know that we can draw anything or conclude anything from that. But, you know, it's 2 things in. I was thinking, things happen in threes, don't they? Something else is going to happen. Then I got ill, and then I nearly lost this great job. And I thought, oh, God, do things just keep happening? Is that how they keep happening now? But what can you do about falling down the stairs? It's because we live in a very narrow house with very steep steps, and my feet protrude over the end of the steps. I'm going to say lip again, the second type of lip. They stick out over the stairs. And what can you do? You can't move house. What can you do? Fireman's pole, trumpet. That's it. That's the options. Anyway, thank you for listening. I don't imagine you have been, but here's to the end of May being filled with positivity and physical health and strength, because they took the cast off yesterday and my little withered, hairy, pale claw that I've not washed in 2 weeks because it's been under a cast. It was just an absolute state. I think the last time I broke something and had a cast removed, I was young and vigorous, and I was like, yes, I'm better now. Whereas now, I was like, can you put the cast back on, please? I feel very weak. Goodbye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.